story of Ruth and Naomi. We'll get to that in just a moment. For those of you who are part of the alumni celebrations this week, I ran across a couple articles on the internet that I thought were rather helpful. This is free advice for your alumni homecoming experience this weekend at La Sierra. A few questions not to ask people that you are meeting and seeing at alumni weekend at homecoming. Question number one, are you dating anyone? Don't lead with that. Or, are you married yet? The yet is not super helpful. One that we're all tempted to ask, but everyone online suggests can be quite painful or maybe awkward is, where do you work? Because you never know what story is behind that question, so they suggest just avoid it. Let them offer that. A few questions in the same vein. Free advice, again, don't ask, have you lost weight? Don't ask, have you gained weight? Don't ask, and this was real advice, have you had some work done? Don't ask those. It's not helpful. Do you have any kids yet? Don't ask that one, please. My favorite, please don't ask. And especially those of you who love to do this, don't cover up your name tag and ask, do you remember me? Because it just can't get better from there. Some of you have had these awkward moments. But if you think your class reunion, your homecoming moment is awkward, just imagine Naomi's. This ancient storyteller in Scripture tells us that when Naomi and her daughter-in-law Ruth arrive home in Bethlehem, the whole town is astir. That's Bible language for saying they're gossiping. As the people gather around and hear the news that Naomi is there, they begin to ask, says the book of Ruth, could this be Naomi? And there's a lot implied in that question. Naomi, the one whose husband years ago thought it was a good idea to leave Bethlehem and go to the land of Moab. Sure, there was a famine and all, but Moab, the forbidden city, if there ever were one for Jews. Why Moab? After all, last time our people went to Moab in search of help when they were fleeing from Egypt, how did that work out? Moab declined hospitality or help. Moab. And so, well, now look who's come home, Ruth, Naomi, now that the famine is over. Could this be Naomi? Her name, Naomi, means pleasant. But as they see her arriving, she looks like anything but pleasant or sweet. Life has been hard for her. They hardly recognize her. This confident, maybe arrogant family of four who set out on an adventure all those years ago has now returned and been reduced to one woman, and a half, if you count this foreigner daughter-in-law that's with her. Could this be Naomi, the pleasant one? She does not exude a sense of pleasantness in her return. The townspeople gather around these two women. It's that awkward moment where you have to decide what it is you're going to say when you're seeing people, how much to say, how much to reveal. Can I put a positive spin on my story? Like, you know, if you've just been fired and don't have a job, you say, well, I'm between jobs right now. I've got some things I'm sort of juggling, working on up in the air. That kind of spin. Can she do it? What will she say? Naomi, in this case, opts for frankness. Here's what the storyteller tells us in Ruth chapter 1. Don't call me Naomi, but call me Mara. which means bitter. For the Almighty has made me very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has returned me empty. Why would you call me Naomi or pleasant when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has deemed me guilty? Well, what do you say to that? The narrator simply says, and thus Naomi returned. That's her homecoming story. So for any of you who find yourselves in awkward conversations over the weekend, you can always opt for the atomic option, like Naomi. Just say in the conversation, well, it's been forever. How are you? I'm awful. Life has left me empty and I am bitter. And I guarantee you, you will be able to get out of that conversation very quickly. Can you relate to this, though, at least a little bit? I was drawn to this story this week, not just for those of you who are participating in Alumni Homecoming Week here at La Sierra, but for all of us who encounter these kinds of situations when we arrive at gatherings of our peers and we worry about how we're going to show up and what we have to show for ourselves. Certainly, we've all asked at least one of these kinds of anxious questions. How do I look? Will they even recognize me? How do I explain what it is I do now? Am I successful enough? Do they know about my failures, about my tragedies? Do they know my stories? What happened to the ambitions that I set out with in the beginning? And what will I say? As for Naomi at her homecoming, she opts for brutal honesty. Call me bitter, for God, for life itself has dealt harshly with me and left me empty and disappointed. I want to suggest today that Naomi's disillusionment and her assessment that life has become barren and empty are an important part of this story of Ruth. Her outlook about life, they represent a certain logic, a certain way of seeing life that invites us first to empathize with it, to understand it. Let's call this logic of Naomi's the logic of merit, or the logic, the legalism of success, achievement, productivity. One way of understanding this story of Ruth and Naomi is to see Naomi, this character, as embodying this basic way of seeing the world, life, based on the principles of working hard to construct and achieve the happiness that we seek. Naomi. And here's why I think there's something deeper like this going on in the story. It's fascinating. Scholars who study Ruth suggest that the primary audience for this story may well have been the Jews, the community of Jews who had recently returned from exile during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. What's notable about life in Jerusalem during this period is the rather intense and rigid conservatism promoted by the political and religious leaders. And it's understandable, really, if we know the story. After the unimaginable existential trauma of exile that was inflicted on this people by Assyria and Babylon, the Persians finally allow them to come home again, to rebuild Jerusalem. This precious opportunity to return home must be handled with utmost care. It can't be lost. And so for Ezra and Nehemiah, this meant doubling down on the belief, on the logic, that the best way to avoid a repeat of exile was to ensure the purity of this community. And so, for example, breaking Sabbath laws carried serious punishment. Listen to the words of Nehemiah himself for talking about traders who are trying to get away with selling on the Sabbath, these merchants. Here's what Nehemiah says in his own words. Once or twice, the traders and sellers of all kinds of merchandise spent the night outside of Jerusalem, hoping to get in immediately after the Sabbath hours. But I warned them, why are you spending the night by the wall? If you do that again, I will lay hands on you, which is biblical threat, I guess. At that point, they stopped coming on the Sabbath. Tough guy, Nehemiah. I also commanded the Levites to purify themselves and to come and guard the gates in order to keep the Sabbath day holy. Nehemiah's approach is, this is so important, I will beat people if they don't comply. He goes on, marriage of foreigners was forbidden as well, and those already married to the foreigners that they met while they were in exile were required to divorce those foreign wives. Here's Nehemiah again. Also in those days, I saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod or the language of various peoples. They couldn't even speak the language of Judah. So I scolded them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. Probably the hair of their beards is what that means. I also made them swear a solemn pledge in the name of God, saying, you won't give your daughters to their sons in marriage or take their daughters in marriage for your sons or yourselves. Close the gates, tighten up the rules, purify the community, because if we can act the right way, do the right things, then our future success and our blessing will be secure. You get what you deserve, and you are as good as what you get. That's the logic of merit, the legalism of achievement and success. If you play by the rules, then you win. If you don't, then you lose. In religious language, we might default to calling this grace versus works, works versus grace. And most of us probably know that the correct theology is that we are saved only, not by our works, but by the grace of God. We can get that sentence right, but the way we order our lives usually reflects anything but grace. We far prefer this logic of merit because, after all, it's what makes the most sense, isn't it? It's what we're taught. It's what we've practiced from birth. There's safety, there's predictability, and there's control in this way of ordering the world. Try harder, seek more success, achieve greater things. If you can reach this point, then you will find stability and security and happiness, those things we long for. If you work hard and get good grades and graduate, then life will be a little bit easier and a little happier. If you take out these student loans that could be the size of a nice car or a small house, then what? They'll practically pay for themselves. And you'll be happier even if they don't. Maybe. If this, then that. It makes sense. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, who's written many books as well, in his latest book, he has a couple distinctions that I think are really helpful. He describes these this way. He said, so there's virtues of all kinds that we seek for and live after in our lives, but there's a couple different kinds. And he likes to make the distinction between resume virtues and eulogy virtues. Great image, isn't it? Resume virtues versus eulogy virtues. Resume virtues are things that we know well. Wealth, fame, status, productivity. All good things. Eulogy virtues are things like kindness, bravery, honesty, faithfulness. Another author, Joan Chittister, says something very similar. She says, she makes the distinction between what we do and who we are. To be sure, these logics of merit, these resume virtues, this doing that we do, have important uses and can be useful and helpful. They are valuable for getting things done in life, and we have to live by them sometimes, right? In constructing our lives, there are important aspects of working hard and succeeding and achieving things and playing by some rules. It's part of life. But when we double down on these things as our hope for meaning and happiness and good life, when we double down on our resumes at the expense of our eulogies, when we double down on doing and what we do at the expense of who we are, we will be disappointed. But it's difficult, isn't it? Because these things seem so important. They always have to humans, actually. Really, this is not unlike what Ezra and Nehemiah and their convictions that getting religion right would lead to blessing. It's the same logic. But that is where the story of Ruth gets interesting, I think. Let's drop Ruth and Naomi's story right into the midst of the conversation with Ezra and Nehemiah. Those readers, Ezra and Nehemiah's time, would recognize the themes in Naomi's story. She, Naomi, has returned home from exile, after all. Exile in a foreign land, and now she's come home, and she is empty, having lost sons and husband. They knew that story. She is disappointed, disillusioned, bitter, but at least she has come home. So as the townspeople gather around with their gossipy talk and judging eyes in the story, these readers in Ezra and Nehemiah's day know exactly what the correct next move is for Naomi. In order to get life back on track, double down on pulling things together. Try harder. Get about fixing whatever it is that she did wrong to bring her to this point. And to start, repent of that awful thing her husband and sons did, marrying Moabite wives, and send this foreign woman back to where she came from. That's how you fix what's gone wrong. But you know that's not how the story goes, is it? I think it's difficult to overstate how surprising and subversive the character of Ruth is to these ancient readers of this story and even to us modern folks. As the hero of this story, she is not only a woman, she's a Moabite foreigner, outside the community of the covenant and its laws and principles and right ways. Yet as this story unfolds, she, Ruth, is the one who courageously commits to caring for her vulnerable mother-in-law. She is the one who boldly asserts her rights to glean in the fields, and so she is the one who can care for this vulnerable family of two. She is the one who audaciously pursues one of the most respected and upright men in town. She's asking him to provide for her and her mother-in-law. And she is the one who woos this righteous man with her words and actions. And he is won over by her irresistible kindness. Listen to this remarkable romance scene in which Ruth has come to Boaz in the middle of the night. Ruth chapter 3, verse 9, Boaz said, "Who are you?" a reasonable question to ask someone who's shown up in the middle of the night. And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. This latest instance of your loyalty, your kindness, your love is better than even the first. You have not gone after young men, whether rich or poor. You've come to me." This word for loyalty is chesed. It's used three times in the book of Ruth. The first two are in the mouth of Naomi, and she's talking about God, as is usually the case. This word, chesed, usually refers to the faithfulness and the loving kindness and the loyalty of God towards God's people and God's creation. But this time, from the mouth of Boaz, the upright man of Bethlehem, chesed, loving kindness, faithfulness, loyalty, these divine characteristics are attributed to Ruth. The unwelcome outsider, this foreign woman, exhibits in this story the loving kindness of God. Remarkably, in this story, Ruth embodies the extravagant and expansive love of God. She is kind and faithful and loyal in her love. She goes above and beyond the strict requirements of laws and traditions and acts with an excess of compassion and care. And in so doing, she saves Naomi from her sense of emptiness and hopelessness. She provides her, by the end of the story, with no less than a son to carry on the family's story. And this is what I think this ancient story is all about. The hero, Ruth, this stranger, the foreigner, the outsider, she breaks into the way things are and offers an alternative to this logic of merit. It's the logic of excess. It's the logic of chesed or loving kindness. It's the logic of God's love, the logic of grace. In the final scene of the story, the crowds of women are gathered around again, and now what they have to say to Naomi has changed quite a bit from the opening scenes. They say, "This child you are holding in your arms, Naomi, will restore your life and sustain you in your old age, all the way until you come back for your 60th reunion. Your daughter-in-law loves you and has given birth to this son. She is better than seven sons." Did you catch that? The foreigner, Ruth, who embodies the faithful loving kindness and loyalty of God, is better than the usual perfect success of bearing seven sons. This way, this gift that Ruth offers restores life and sustains life as the years go by. And so what is this gift again? First, this gift that will restore our lives and sustain us as the years go by is the gift of knowing that our value and our worth are not measured by the logic of achievement and success, about being an insider or an outsider, about productivity or what we do, but instead our worth and our value come to us out of the excess and extravagance of divine love. The faithfulness and the loyalty and the kindness of God to each of us and to all of us. And if there's a second lesson from Ruth, perhaps it is this. Those things, those people, those circumstances that we spend so much time and so much energy holding at bay, trying to avoid, those things that we are sure would ruin us if they came, failure, disappointments, unfulfilled dreams and plans and hopes, those unwelcome intruders just may come to us bearing a gift that gives life. Because it may be these very things that will actually break our loyalty to the logic of merit and success and achievement and open us to the logic of loving kindness and grace. In closing, here's one way I think this might look. Many of you have probably caught the story of one of the contestants in the TV show Dancing with the Stars, Noah Galloway, Sergeant Noah Galloway. He's a veteran of the Iraq War who lost an arm and a leg when he was serving in 2005 when his Humvee hit a landmine. Week 4 of this TV dance competition was the week in which the dances reflected the dancers' stories a bit. Noah's dance was notable in part because he chose to dance shirtless, and so exposing instead of covering the stump where his arm was and his prosthetic leg. It was, as you would expect, a moving and emotional dance. And it had all the made-for-TV elements orchestrated to elicit just those kinds of emotions. There were stars and stripes, there was patriotic music, there were themes of sacrifice and overcoming obstacles and hardships. Again, all good things. By the end, the judges were in tears, as were probably most of the viewers, maybe some of you. And while some of the tears in response were probably from the usual TV sentimentality that happens nightly, I think there was something deeper in this case, something deeper in Noah's story and his dance that were tapped into, that tapped into us. On the one hand, the story of Noah's invokes for all of us our worst fears. For him, through a most unwelcome intrusion from the outside, much of the self that Noah had built through career and achievements and his physical strength, all of it disappeared in an instant. Our worst fear. But on the other hand, the story also offered profound hope for us viewers. Because what saved Noah was finally letting go of these losses, perhaps even making friends with them, we could say. This is what he says on the show just before his dance. This dance represents the journey of acceptance from the man I was to the man I am. And from watching him and listening to him, one gets the sense that this gift of acceptance and loving kindness towards himself first and towards the world, this outlook has indeed restored life to him, and it will sustain him as the years go by. What we do matters some. Who we are matters immensely. The logic of merit gets stuff done. The logic of extravagant love makes life worth living. So may God give us strength and courage for the journey we are on. And may this journey lead us to find our home in the extravagance of divine love.